this edition of Warrior Sound coming to you from Boston as the Warriors are taking on the Celtics. And we got a chance to talk with Warriors TV analyst Jim Barnett about the history of the Celtics as he played his rookie season in the NBA here in Boston. And a little bit later, we'll check in with ESPN's Adrian Wojnarowski about DeMarcus Cousins. That and more. But here is our conversation with JB from Beantown.
The league is so different than it was then in so many ways. Obviously, financially, it was a struggling league, and it was a small league. The year that I came in, 1956, they added a new team, Chicago Bulls. So that made team number 10 in the NBA at that time. And so you played everyone nine times. And so it was a smaller league. You knew everybody. You knew all the officials. Everybody, was on the same page that way. And in order to make ends meet, you played a lot of exhibition games. The training camp was a month long with many exhibition games. And I remember with the Celtics, we played intra-squad games throughout the training and in the second and third week of training camp where we would go out to high school gymnasiums and Red Auerbach would charge a dollar to get some revenue, and you'd play a game between the greens and the whites, intra-squad game, but no one had guaranteed contracts. And so these were really, this was 48 minutes of competitive basketball. And then we played 15 exhibition games, and once we played 12 games in 12 straight nights in 10 different states, primarily traveling by bus. Once in a while, a little plane ride if you had to go a little distance, but you travel with the opposition, the opposing team, either St. Louis Hawks or Philadelphia 76ers, on the bus with you, and you were like vagabonds. You would go 2 hours down the road, so we played 12 nights in a row, which would be unheard of today. So we played 23 full 48-minute games before the season began, and this was with a team that had won 8 straight championships. They were the creme de la creme of the NBA. It was all new to me, and of course, I was trying to make the team, even though I was their number one draft pick. That doesn't mean anything if you can't perform, and so I felt that there was a lot of pressure.
You know, the old Boston Garden was where you played. We'll talk about the floor there in just a second, but I mean, kind of take us back to what the vibe was in the city as it related to the Celtics back then.
Well, they were, even though the 8 straight championships, they didn't sell out every game. It's interesting. They were still had to have a lot of marketing to try to get people to the arena. And it was a hockey town. The Boston Bruins were number one. And they had my rookie year when I was 22, they had a young phenom, 18-year-old Bobby Orr, who's one of the great players in hockey, obviously, in the Hall of Fame of everything. And so that was the number one game. And so the NBA to try to drum up interest and get more fans, we played a lot of doubleheaders. So we played a lot of doubleheaders in New York, where maybe Detroit and St. Louis will play the first game, and then the Knicks and the Celtics will play the second game. Or in Boston, our doubleheaders, I remember a few times, the first game were the Harlem Globetrotters. And the Harlem Globetrotters would play, and then we, the Celtics, would play whatever team it was, Detroit or Philadelphia or St. Louis or whomever it may be, afterwards, Baltimore Bullets. So it was the doubleheaders, I remember several times, and including in New York, the Globetrotters would play the first game of the doubleheader. It was kind of strange.
That's seemingly unfathomable. So we're traveling with the other teams in this time period, and the Globetrotters are the opening act for NBA games. That is quite remarkable. And you think then of the physical space that was the old Boston Garden. And I mean, you hear about the championships where like the air conditioner may have not been working and it was like sweltering in there. Or the story I always heard was about the floor having real dead spots and that being a critical advantage to Celtics players because they knew where the ball might not bounce back and they could pick up a steal.
Absolutely. There was one particular spot just past half court. And I'm trying to think whether it be east, west, whatever, north, south. We all knew where it was. And Casey Jones was a very, very good defender. And he would pick up his man just before half court and direct him to that corner and that part and that square. You know, it was all the little squares in there, the parquet floor. He would direct him to that spot. And that ball, instead of coming up 3 feet in the air, would come up about 18 inches. And they picked up a lot of steals that way. There were other couple little spots, and they were, it just, the floor was not always in the best shape. For, you know, they were putting them up and down for the hockey games, back and forth, and it got beat up through the years. So it was interesting. But I will tell you this, the rims at the Boston Garden were the most forgiving rims I've ever seen in any NBA venue, in any arena, any gymnasium. They gave a lot, and they were what we call forgiving rims. They were shooter friendly, and that kind of helped. It's interesting because that's the way it was. It wasn't everything was not unified in those days, and so they weren't. It just everything wasn't as ABC clockwork type thing. And once in a while, you'd have to come. The basket would be set up cockeyed in an arena. And they had to come out, and if you didn't say anything about it, you played the game that way, okay? But you had to protest a little bit, and they'd maybe delay the game trying to get the angle of the backboard and the angle of the rim in the right direction. So it was really different. But the Celtics, you know, they were led. They had Bill Russell, and he was the greatest winner of all time. And that Celtics team, what I learned, and sometimes that didn't see, the lessons I learned didn't sink in until years later in my NBA career, because they had there was a mystique about the Celtics, and they believed they were the best. They believed they rightfully owned everything to be the best. Red Auerbach was not always liked by other general managers and owners around the league and other coaches. You know, I played in New York for Red Holtzman, and they were contemporaries, but not real friendly ones. A lot of people were maybe jealous of Red Auerbach. They also thought he was a little pompous and a little cocky. But the Celtics, they had that air about them where they carried themselves, and they felt they were different. They felt they were better, and they demanded that you you come to that same kind of understanding and same kind of aura, and that's it was Celtics. And I've got, you know, a lot of stories and them talking about you know, we're the Celtics, and this is, we're above, we're the best team in the league, and we're always going to be the best team in the league.
You've played for so many different franchises, and in some cases, like with the Portland Trailblazers in an inaugural season, or with a young franchise, the Jazz, before they moved to Utah in New Orleans, and of course the Warriors. But to hear about your time with the Celtics, your rookie year, and how once a Celtic, always a Celtic, that's some very special stuff.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I've got stories about Bill Russell, seeing him years later, and him asking me about my wife, Sandy. And I remember this is in Los Angeles. I think we were playing in the playoffs in maybe 91 against the Lakers. And I'd gone to a shoot around, and he came in, and I hadn't seen him in several years, and we started chatting. And he asked about Sandy, and I said, well, she's fine, Bill. And I'm really surprised that you would remember her name. And he said, very, very, very seriously, Jim, you were a Celtic. There aren't many Celtics around. And he made me feel about 10 feet tall. But that's the way Bill Russell, how he carries himself. And talking about going to other teams, and I went in expansion draft several different times because I came into the league while it was growing. This was the biggest growth. This was the bull market, if you will, of the NBA from 66 on, and particularly out through the 70s. Because when I came in the league, 10 teams, when I left the league 11 years later, 12 years later, there were 23 teams, so it had more than doubled in size during my playing days.
Unbelievable stuff, and we will continue with these stories here on Warrior Sound as we get into game breakdowns. Of course, the Barnett breakdown making a triumphant start after the win in Washington as the Warriors took down the Wizards, and we talked with Jim Barnett, and as the season unfolds and into the playoffs, we'll be doing so much more here on Warrior Sound. Jim, thank you so much.
All right, Lawrence. We'll look forward to the future.
Here in Boston, the Warriors and Celtics, a matchup bringing out some of the top names covering the NBA as we talked with ESPN's Adrian Wojnarowski about DeMarcus Cousins and the impact Woj expects Cousins will make for the Warriors.
I mean, it's remarkable, and you watch, you know, Cousins, you know, physically start to get his timing back and conditioning, and you know he's still a long way away from, you know, what he probably will be by the playoffs and late season, postseason, and yet you've already seen the kind of weapon he can be for this team, and something they haven't had. It's a team that has everything, you know, adds him in, and it's going to just make them, it's already made them, given them this dimension that they probably didn't need, but they have, you can see them integrating into it. I thought was interesting when they signed him, you know, Bob Myers talked about having felt maybe last year things got a little stale and the team had to fight through, you know, the regular season with the postseason success they had, and that working DeMarcus into the lineup and working him into this team was going to be, he thought, a real positive for the group. And I know he and Steve Kerr talked about that when they signed him, that it kind of gave the group a challenge and it gave them, you know, to give them something else in the regular season, you know, that they had to focus and work on. And listen, this year it already presented some challenges. Looking back, maybe it wouldn't have, but you can see how it's starting to come together. And I think the great thing for Cousins is there's no pressure. There's no pressure for him to produce or put numbers up or play minutes, you know. And that's allowing him to do this at his own pace and at the group's pace.
If you looked into a crystal ball and you thought of what you anticipate to be the biggest stories ahead here before All-Star break, as things are kind of shaping up, where teams are trying to make their moves to be competitive for the playoffs or even just around the All-Star break, what do you kind of envision?
I mean, you know, certainly the trade deadline on February 7th and whether Marcus Saul, Mike Conley are on the move, I think they're by far the two most impactful players available at the deadline right now. Now, sometimes talks can generate elsewhere, but, you know, we've seen the last few trade deadlines, what they've increasingly become, in most cases, are just money dumps. Teams getting out of luxury tax, teams, you know, who are sellers, who are out of the playoff mix, trying to get young players or picks or get money off. And so that will probably be most of this. And then I think you'll have a really interesting post-trade deadline buyout market. I think you'll see, you know, teams will try to trade some players here, and if they don't get them off by the 7th, then you'll see some buyouts and then some really good players available for contending teams to pick off and maybe fill a need with.
Cool. Woj, thanks so much for joining us here on Warrior Sound.
Thank you.